everybody, welcome to a brand new part of Black Hole Cinema with me, Tony Black, your genial host. This is Black Hole Classics, a whole new venture in which we've taken the idea of the Lost Interviews, which was when I did interviews with the old in the old style of the podcasts, and I ended up keeping them on a hard drive forever. And now I've decided, right, we're going to do classic films that people want to talk about. And this is the very team of Black Hole Cinema. The first one, the inaugural Black Hole Classic, is with the film reviewing legend himself, Leslie Byron Pitt. Good evening, Les.
How are you doing? You all right?
I'm great, thank you very much. I'm not too bad at all. So what film have you chosen to go with for this first Black Hole Classic?
Well, I've decided to go with The Night of the Hunter.
What do you see, girl? You see the flesh of Eve that man since Adam has profaned. That body was meant for begetting children. It was not meant for the lust of men.
I've been bad.
What you been up to, Ruby?
I've been out with men.
Child.
What'd you tell me? Where's the money hid?
But I swore I promised John I would tell.
John doesn't matter!
It's one of the films I watched when I was, I say quite young, I watched it a while back when I was 16, I think, around that time, and I did fall in love with it. It was one of those films that when I was studying film, it kind of popped up on the internet movie database or Ebert site, and the way they talked about it, and I really wanted to watch it. And I watched it then, and now, recently, I'm not sure if it's Masters of Cinema or possibly Arrow, have re-released it recently on Blu-ray, and we're really, really lucky here in England. We've got some really great kind of boutique DVD distributors who are looking back at the old stuff, be it the sleazy, trashy stuff, the European erotica. It doesn't really bother them, and then they've also got, you know, we've got the likes of Masters of Cinema and Arrow doing some more classic stuff. They know there's a market still out there for Blu-rays and DVD. So, Night of the Hunter, then.
This is a really, really good choice, actually. And you came to it when you were much younger. I only watched it for the first time a few weeks ago when we talked about doing this. And I've been curious about it for a long, long time. And I confess, my knowledge of film going back this far and beyond is sorely lacking. It's something I need to sort out over the next few years. So this is it's not very often I watch a film that's 50s or previously, but I've always been fascinated by this one, and I thought it was remarkably good.
A quick synopsis is, it's a tale of a devious character named Henry Powell, who he's a corrupt preacher, or says he's a preacher, who uses his charms to woo an unsuspecting widow and her two children, and he attempts to try and steal a fortune of their of the woman's dead husband. And, you know, it opens up with this lovely kind of aerial shot before cutting to goes to Robert Mitchum, who plays the preacher, and it's this tale of, you know, it cuts from this air shot, and you know, you don't really see so much of that back in the day, to that it cuts to him in this car talking as if he is a preacher and talking about these values and morals in a certain way, but they're not really. He's actually talking about how he, you know, he's getting rid of people and, you know, his deviousness, and he kind of dresses it up. It cuts to the fact that he's stolen the car and he killed someone in order to steal the car.
It's such a dark opening to a film like this, you know.
But I think that's one of the things. It's one of these old films which is looking in the Southern Gothic, and it has these noir elements in there as well. And it was directed by a guy called Charles Laughton, who was a very, very famous actor back in the day in his time, and he decided to go into doing directing, and he was very high in theatre and whatnot, but he decided to go into directing. And this is the only film he ever made.
It's really tragic that.
It's the only film he ever made. He never got past the critical, you know, critically it didn't do very well at the time. And commercially didn't do very well at the time. But one of the things he did really well, one of the things that happened is he made this film and he never went back into it. But one of the things that the film seemed to have happened, it just seemed to stick by, and it found an audience somehow. And in 1992, the United States Library of Congress deemed The Night of the Hunter to be culturally or historically and aesthetically significant. And one of the reasons why is Lawton was much better with directing kids and people, because it comes from an acting background. But he gave the cinematography to
Stanley Cortez.
Thank you. Stanley Cortez. I should really remember Stanley Cortez, because obviously of his work in the likes of Citizen Kane, who decide to set up these big, expansive, like grand expressionistic sets in order to make the film. And the thing that I absolutely love about it is you see so many iconic and beautiful moments throughout. And that's just one thing. We can get onto the acting and everything, because he gets some good performances out of child actors. He gets some really good he gets a really good performance out of someone like Robert Mitchum, who was always a strong performer anyway. It's great to see him in something like this, and then later on watching in like when he gets older in something in 1995's Dead Man, and he's just got this fantastic face and perform this really grand style of. And he really seems to landmark and highlight this style of like Americana. It's something about him.
There's a naturalism, isn't there, about him? I think there's a naturalism in a way in terms of just how he exudes this dangerous sort of charisma, certainly in this film especially. And Lawton really brings that out of him.
The thing I love about him, now that you bring it up, is people thought he was from the South, and he wasn't. But he just ended up in these sort of Southern Gothic movies and films like Cape Fear. And he's so good. But one of the things I love, and going back to what I was saying, is just the visual aspect of it. These massive expressionistic sets. It doesn't look like any film of that time.
It's got
these really odd, and when I say it doesn't look like any films of that time, it doesn't look like the likes of Citizen Kane, which was earlier, it doesn't look like anything, just around that time. Even stuff that I really love of the 50s, like Sunset Boulevard, it doesn't even look like that.
Well, it feels like it's bridging sort of two kind of ages in a way. I think it's like, we're in the mid 50s. Hollywood and the world itself was coming out of this, this age of war and austerity and everything, and it was now going into the counterculture revolution period where everything was brighter and more colourful and, all that kind of thing. And this seems to be like this really stark, and we can get into the themes of it later, but it seems like this really stark reminder of serious Christian values and, and corruption. And it really hits home, because it does, from what I like I said, I haven't seen everything from that decade, but it really stands out as something that was so unusual to people. It was a real kind of gut punch, even then.
But I think the thing is, it's such a bizarre film in itself. There's some visuals in it that are so kind of otherworldly.
Yeah.
There's a sort of morbid sense of humour that plays throughout.
Definitely.
But one of the things I like, it is a film, I wouldn't say that I'm a religious person, but one of the things I like about film is it has this sort of battle of good and evil and pure faith and pure of heart. We haven't really mentioned that later on there is a character that comes along later on. It's Lillian Gish, who plays Rachel Cooper later on, and there's a reason why. We have Robert Mitchum's pal character terrorizing these kids to try and find out what happened to this to the stolen funds of their dead father. They set off on this really grand adventure, and I don't really want to say too much, because there's other things that happen. And like one of the most remarkable scenes is obviously the scene underwater of a dead body just floating in the reeds. Yeah. And it's in such a really weird way, and it's really ethereal and beautiful, but you realise the extent of how evil this man is.
Yes, because he is that pure manifestation of that, really. He's the man in black. He's the proper terrifying spectre, and he becomes even more, because without spoiling it, the last half of the film, he's far more of a, you know, shadowy kind of presence stalking. You know, he has less to say. He's not even in it quite as much, and it's much more about how the good is trying to counterweight him. And he really does create that. He makes the Terminator look like just nothing.
You know, but he's also really, he's grand and charismatic.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think this is one thing that I've found lacking in villains as of late. But that's one thing I love about Mitchum in this as well. It's all very big, bold, preachy, and you know, that sort of grand gestures, and his face is at times is just, sometimes it's bordering on hilarious and funny, but he's also unnerving and weird and strange and just not a nice character to being. And one, and it's a bit like some of Lynch's best films, where he shoots it from this kid's point of view, these children's point of view, and this man is scary because he's very odd, and all the adults seem to just fall in love with him so quickly.
It's that temptation, sort of Lucifer kind of Satan kind of charm, isn't it? He just bewitches them all, really, most of them anyway.
But I love that. I love the fact that the adults are so naive. I think that's one of the reasons probably why commercially it didn't do very well. They didn't like the idea that you had these characters who are so easily taken in. But, you know, there's a lot to say from something like that, especially in that time where people were more sort of church fearing. And this deals with, you know, Southern Gothic in such an interesting way, where it puts those things on the line and goes, there are charlatans out there, and there are people of true faith. Mm. And that's the sort of thing I kind of really enjoy, where, you know, where good can may be able to triumph for evil, but you still have these elements of darkness in there. It's all shot in wonderful, like this really wide expansive of shots. There's a beautiful moment where the naive character that Shelley Winters plays, and she plays the poor kid's mother, she kind of just about realizes what seems to be going on, and there's this fantastic grand scheme where she's talking and he, you know, he's all this posturing for Mitchum, and it's such a weird shot because it's not close up at all, it's really far in distance in and kind of chilly, and but it's still really expressionistic. It's just these fantastically bizarre uses of space. And it just gives it a really wonderful otherworldly quality about the film. It's just powerfully evocative for me. I find it that.
It's got this really kind of, and you mentioned it before, that it has these really strange, you know, visuals, and it's got, and it ties into thematically what the film is, really, I think, in that it's very operatic in the sense of this battle between good and evil, and the staunch religious themes going all the way through it. And it really, that's why I like Lillian Gish so much in it. And it's amazing that, you know, I mean, she was the silent film, you know, grand dame, wasn't she, Lillian Gish?
Yes.
So to be able to be coming in and being so good, I mean, she almost matches Mitchum in terms of the star performance here. She's fabulous.
But I think that's one of the things I really loved. I loved about the silent actresses and actors that carried on and managed to continue. Obviously, you've got people like Gloria Swanson, who wasn't a silent character, and they were allowed to do all these grand gestures. And I think now we're so used to a certain style of acting, we probably wouldn't be able to see that stuff again. But you watch it in these older films, and they seem so, it's so interesting and stylistic. Mm. And wonderful, and you know, and I dare I say it, bold. There's something about having these grand and bold and really sort of heady performances, as opposed to now, where everyone sometimes plays things down.
It's maybe reflective of the times, you know, possibly. I think it's ironic in that in a world where people would be very repressive and repressed, and you know, in the 50s you had a great deal of that kind of post-war repression balanced against this counterculture, like I said before. And then you have something so operatic and grand that people struggle to get their heads around, and then it becomes beloved later. And that's why, you know, Charles Laughton is... I think Daniel Day-Lewis called him, you know, the greatest actor who ever lived. And when it's coming from Daniel Day-Lewis, then he is, you know... We're talking about a giant here. And it's somebody who was misunderstood in his time. And then, ironically, when you flip that round, in the days where everything is, oh my God, grand, epic, legendary, where everyone's dramatic, and then... Like you say, people tend to play things down. You know, it is strange, but that doesn't have nearly the same impact as a film with such grand, you know, like I say, operatic gothic stylistics or something like this. And that's why even now, it really strikes a chord. It unnerves. It's, you know, it does bewitch you, like Henry Powell bewitches these people. And it's quite stunning, really, in the way it looks, and as well in the way it's written as well, because it's that fantastic screenplay that really brings out these characterizations, and using terms like people being called lambs, you know, he calls everyone lambs, you know, all the time, which is really creepy
but also really, you know, obvious as well, in the sense of they're all sheep, you know, easily led.
And then, you know, with the shooting, like with, you know, taking a cue from all the 1920s German expressionism, and, you know, shadows on walls and looming spectres and moonlight casting down on open plains and things like that. It's just really quite powerful in the way it looks, in the way it feels. And it's just so dark. But yet with that element of, without ruining it, that element of hope and that whole central idea of childhood innocence and, you know, how children can maybe, you know, be saved from this kind of elemental evil, really.
Yeah. Well, you know, the big thing and one of the last lines is Lillian Gish saying along the lines of, we abide, we continue on, we find the time, we find this faith and hope and glory. It's a really lovely, well put together, like, kind of aspect there. But it is just, it's one of the things I kind of love for movies in general. It's one of the reasons why I kind of like going back to it, because at no way we like to say there is a simpler time. I don't think so. I think what happens is we've kind of, so we, you know, we kind of sift out so much and we only take on so much. But there were some real, I think one of the reasons why I really enjoy so many films from certain eras and whatnot is because the dark ones seem to just kind of pop out, be it film noir or even the really caustic, films from someone like Billy Wilder at his best, something like Ace in the Hole. But, you know, with this, it's this beautiful thing on, it gets the balance right, and it's just got this, I really love the tone of it and how it looks and what it looks like, and it just generally, you know, I've been kind of delving into the Southern Gothic for a little while, just the last week or so, and watching films like Wise Blood. It's just got all these, you know, these fantastic characters that seem to just, that come out of it. And, you know, we haven't even got on to, like, Powell's talk about the struggle between love and hate, and how he
and the knuckles.
You know, this stuff that you see in, you know, one of the things that I love is that pops up in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. And it comes from a completely different character with a completely different perspective on life, but on his brass, he's got brass knuckles doing the exact saying something completely different, but just that element, and it shows what kind, how deep someone like Spike Lee was looking into America and how these things do get transferred, and they do transfer from race and politics and religion, and how, you know, how these things are watched and seen.
Well, you can see the influences in a lot of people from this. You can see the influences in, you know, Scorsese, you know, in the Coens. You know, there's lots of different people who you can tell have watched like this film and have been marked by it when they were younger. People who are now producing films that will be as well regarded in 50 years' time, you know, 60 years' time. Just, it is one of those films that people haven't forgotten necessarily, but I think it's not as well remembered as your Citizen Kanes and your, you know, and your films like that from similar eras. And I think that it really deserves to be. And it's one really that mainly people involved in film or film enthusiasts know and revere. And it would be nice if more people knew the legacy, really, that a film like that has cast, really, over, like I said before, a lot of filmmakers and a lot of Hollywood and a lot of the way things, you know, happened since. So it's a great choice for the first ever Black Hole classic. So thank you, Liz. Thank you for coming on and discussing this one.
Well, thank you for having me.
Hopefully we can recommend that to everybody and, you know, they'll go and pick themselves up a copy. You can find Les at AfroFilmViewer on Twitter, and you have a website,
AfroFilmViewer.com,
yep. Where Les writes many great reviews and blogs about things, so do check him out.
Yes.
I'm on Twitter at Black Hole Writer, and at Black Hole Cinema is Black Hole Cinema, as you already know. Black Hole Classics will be back very soon. Thanks, Les. Thanks again for coming on.
No problem.
And we'll see you all again very soon. Take care, guys.
The combined powers of Paul Gregory and Charles Laughton brought the King Mutiny Court Martial to Broadway. Now the screen receives that same creative, electrifying impact. The Night of the Hunter.